From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Frances Alonso reporting. President Barack Obama delivered a statement on Guantanamo earlier this hour. It happened at the White House. His administration is prepared to present U.S. lawmakers with a plan to close the controversial military prison.
For many years, it's been clear that the detention facility at Guantanamo Bay does not advance our national security. It undermines it. This is not just my opinion. This is the opinion of experts. This is the opinion of many in our military. It's counterproductive to our fight against terrorists because they use it as propaganda in their efforts to recruit. It drains military resources. With nearly $450 million spent last year alone to keep it running.
Meanwhile, the U.S. Defense Department is delivering a report today to Congress on how to close the military detention center at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. You can read more on the president's comments at voanews.com. Syria said Tuesday it accepts a ceasefire plan proposed by the United States and Russia that would begin on Saturday. A government statement said the military will continue its operations against the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda-linked groups. The U.S.-Russia plan does not apply to those militants, and any other groups have until Friday to confirm their participation. A water crisis in India's capital will take up to 2 weeks to fix, according to authorities there Tuesday. Taps ran dry days after protesters sabotaged a canal to demand better treatment for their caste. The Jat caste groups called off their protests on Monday after the government in Haryana accepted their demands. This is VOA News. United Nations Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says Burundi President Pierre Nkurunziza has agreed to begin talks with opposition leaders to bring an end to a year-long political crisis. Mr. Ban announced a breakthrough Tuesday in the capital of Bujumbura.
I was very much encouraged that the political leaders, whether they are sitting in government ruling party or opposition, they promised that they will engage in inclusive dialogue. This is what President Nkurunziza also confirmed, that he is engaging in inclusive dialogue.
Mr. Bond's visit comes a month after a UN Security Council delegation traveled to the country to press for negotiations among Nkurunziza and his opponents. Greece has filed a formal protest with Austria over its recent actions involving the migrant crisis. The Greek foreign ministry summoned the Austrian ambassador to Athens to express anger over Vienna's decision to limit the number of asylum applications, which could leave thousands of migrants stranded in Greece. Athens is also angry over not being invited to a meeting on Wednesday in Austria with several Balkan states, including Albania, Bosnia, Macedonia, and Slovenia, about the migrant crisis. An Egyptian court ordered Tuesday the release of an Al-Qaeda chief, Ayman al-Zawahiri's brother, who is under investigation for calling for the creation of a terrorist group, according to an official. Mohammed al-Zawahiri, 64, was arrested in August 2013, a month after the army's ouster of the Islamist president, Mohammed Morsi, and at the height of a crackdown against his supporters. He and dozens of other defendants were accused of having formed a terrorist group linked to al-Qaeda and plotting attacks on government installations, security forces, and Egypt's Christian minority, all charges which defense lawyers deny. A Swedish doctor has been sentenced to 10 years in prison for abducting a woman and locking her in a homemade bunker for 6 days. In a unanimous verdict, a Stockholm court found 38-year-old Martin Trenenberg guilty of drugging and abducting the woman. The prosecutor said he had planned to hold the woman as his girlfriend in a specially constructed bunker behind his isolated home. Supporters of Apple and its objections to helping the FBI break into an iPhone used by a mass shooter are planning protests in more than 40 cities Tuesday, including at the FBI's headquarters in Washington. A digital rights group called Fight for the Future is organizing the events at Apple stores in places such as New York, San Francisco, Minneapolis, Hong Kong, and London. More details on this and more at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Aegis Wuhib, and coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight.
You can tell a family of 10 to get 20 kgs. That means they will only eat in the afternoon. What happens to them in the evening?
That's Amina Khalid, a Blantyre resident, complaining about limits on the amount of emergency maize supplies given to the public. Details coming up.
Also, the United Nations Human Rights Office is condemning violence and alleged human rights abuses that marred last week's presidential elections in Uganda. And CAR refugees in Cameroon talk about their expectations for peace talks.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Senegal, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, following talks with UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, President Pierre Nkurunziza announced that he promised to release 2,000 Burundians who have been detained in recent months of political conflict and violence in the country. David Arnold talked with VOA correspondent Moses Havayarimana in Bujumbura about today's events.
Yes, the announcement of the release of the prisoners comes after the Burundian government has actually cancelled out the international arrest warrants on one of Burundian individuals who fled the country during the crisis. That included the former parliament speaker and the former second vice president who actually fled the country during last year when the protest against President Pierre Nkurunziza started. However, the UN Secretary General said that it showed that the Burundian government was willing to go for dialogue, for an inclusive dialogue as it could, and urged the Burundian government to do more about the release of the personnel and also cancellation of arrest warrants of other individuals who could contribute in the inclusive dialogue.
I understand, however, that the announcement was made that 2,000 prisoners would be released. Do the people of Burundi, have they learned about the release of the prisoners or the promise of release, and who are the prisoners?
Yeah, this came as a surprise. Nobody knew that if the president is going to release the 2,000 prisoners. However, now the Burundians, it gives them a light and it gives them some hope that possibly their families or their relatives who went in the protest last year could be otherwise released, and they give them hope to return back home. So some of the Burundians have been happy about the decision, but they still wait when exactly they're going to be released. This is not the first time, actually, the president is releasing these prisoners. Late last year, released other prisoners, and who later first went into the some trainings and in order to develop some skills in their daily activities and contribution to the society. So these prisoners were not directly released to go and back to their home, but rather they had to go under some specific education and learning some skills in order to contribute to the society.
And the announcement that was made this morning, how was it on radio? Is it in newspapers now? And is the reaction from the public that these are credible reports and that they expect?
We have tried to approach the normal citizens, and they were really welcoming the decision by the government. Actually, it was announced early in the morning during the press conference when after the UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon met President Pierre Nkurunziza in his one-day visit, after meeting some political opposition leaders in order to urge them to engage in an inclusive dialogue.
And what do you expect, or what do people publicly expect to happen now? Do they think the opposition will actually be able to meet with the president?
Sorry?
Is there a public reaction that they find the people of Burundi find it credible that the president is actually going to meet with the opposition leaders now?
Yeah, the problem is what kind of opposition the government is going to meet. Because now the government says it's not going to dialogue, will not dialogue with what is said to be the coup plotters who tried to oust the government. Remember that these are some of the opposition leaders who fled the country during the crisis and have been accused of trying to oust the president. So the government said it won't go into dialogue with those who tried to who supported the coup. So these are the leading oppositions who have already fled the country. So that means actually that the opposition who are already outside the country, some of them will not be engaged in the dialogue, and who are critical and who are to be at the crisis. Actually, they're contributing much more in this political crisis which is happening now in the country. So the Burundi president has already admitted that he will carry out the inclusive dialogue, he will engage the political opposition stakeholders, but there is that context of they tried to oust the government, and the government saying that it will not go in dialogue with those who tried to oust the president.
So this is not going to be an all-inclusive dialogue, but a dialogue directed by the president toward which individual groups?
Yes. Yeah. Actually, the president, Pierre Nkurunziza, said that the dialogue will include all Burundian citizens. Actually, the dialogue has already, he set up a commission of the dialogue that is now conducting the dialogue in all the provinces in the country. However, the opposition who are outside the country, they say that this is not the kind of dialogue they need. It's not inclusive. If they are left out, as the African Union and the European Union and the international community urged the Burundian government to agree and go to the dialogue that is mediated by President Museveni, which is expected, actually, which was expected to take place in Arusha, which didn't. So the president, you see, there is a dilemma where, actually, if the dialogue under mediation of Museveni will still continue or not, which most of the opposition out of the country were urging the international community to push for.
Having heard the announcements today, do people on the streets feel that there is renewed hope for reconciliation in the country?
Yes, exactly. They feel like it gives them a little bit of hope.
That was Moses Habayarimana talking to VOA's David Arnold about news of a possible political reconciliation in Burundi. A recent study finds that livestock donations significantly increase poor people's household incomes. The University of Illinois College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences conducted the study in poor households in rural Zambia to determine if livestock donations really benefited the recipients. The research, funded by Elanco Animal Health, found that in approximately 300 households in Zambia, the budget increased 25%. Which is a significant boost. The study also found that people who received animals changed their diets in favor of higher nutritional foods such as milk. Alex Winter Nelson is professor of the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics at the University of Illinois. He spoke with me about the significance of the study.
The livestock donations have been going on for a long time. Heifer International has been doing it for over 50 years, and there's lots of testimonials out there from people who've received animals about the impact it's had, but there's no real rigorous measurement of what those impacts have been in terms of incomes or diet or expenditures. It's been hard to actually measure impacts because it's hard to isolate the effects of getting an animal from other related things like the environment or a person's capacity as a farmer or a livestock manager. At the same time, and we know that livestock and farm animals are very important in sub-Saharan Africa. They play lots of different roles, but it's really been difficult to isolate the specific impact of increasing animal productivity or the number of animals, again, because it's difficult to isolate the effect of the animals from other factors like the physical environment or the farmer's ability. This research was important because by cooperating with Heifer International, we were able to construct an experiment where we could, in some sense, control for other factors and isolate the impacts of the livestock themselves. In the Copper Belt, there hadn't been very many farm animals because people had relied heavily on mining jobs. Those mining jobs had dried up. Cooperating with Heifer, we were able to identify specific communities that would be receiving services right away and other communities that would have to wait.
How many households participated in the survey?
In our survey, we had about 330 households to start with. We followed these households over 3 years, and we ended up with about 300.
What types of livestock were donated, and what was the effect of the livestock?
Depending on the conditions in the community, that is, the amount of water, the access to markets, a household either received dairy cows or draft cattle or goats. They would get one dairy cow, two draft cattle, or a group of seven goats. The impacts were pretty dramatic. Pretty rapidly, the households that received these animals saw increased incomes. Their general expenditures rose because they had more purchasing power, and their diets changed. The food consumed shifted to include more food groups, and particularly include a lot more dairy products and also meat in some cases. In a way, that wasn't too surprising. These people received a valuable gift, and their incomes and their consumption changed. What was really surprising and encouraging was to see that other households in the communities also had their diets change. When some households in the communities received dairy animals, for instance, there was a spillover effect so that their neighbors started consuming more milk and seeing improved diets.
Households went from a dollar per day as far as the family budget to $1.25 per day. So this was quite a significant increase for them. So what would be the long-term effects?
So we've been able to follow these households for more than 3 years now. And one thing we see is that they're reinvesting in productive activities. So that movement from a dollar a day to $1.25 a day is what people are consuming. But additional to that, they're reinvesting in their farms. The herds of animals are growing. They're also reinvesting in things like solar panels to light their homes, which we think might be having an impact on school performance for children. So this seems to be triggering some pretty significant transformations.
What were some of the concerns regarding the donating of the livestock?
One issue is the capacity of people to maintain these animals. When you give someone an animal, the expectation is it'll be taken care of, and further that the female offspring from that animal will be given to other households in the community. So the capacity of poor households to manage those animals is very important, and Heifer spends a lot of effort in training households so that they can manage those animals. Another concern is there's a temptation to give the animals to people who have the capacity already to take care of them, and those won't be necessarily households in great need. What we found was that Heifer, in fact, does a good job of targeting very poor households and also providing them with the training and the skills they need to succeed. There's also some concern that when you introduce animals into small farms, there might be sanitation issues. And again, in these contexts, Heifer is very careful to train households and give them the skills and tools to make sure that animal waste is properly managed and they don't get contaminated water and things like that as a result. So one of the things we tracked was diarrheal disease and problems that might reflect sanitation problems. We didn't see any negative outcomes like that.
What other countries are you planning to do a similar type of study in Africa?
We are looking at similar programs to invest in rural communities in Ghana, in Malawi, in Kenya, and those investments are things like extension and what impact it has on rural households, improve the extension services to them, both in terms of farm production, but also in terms of food consumption and nutrition. We're also doing work on soybeans and the development of soybeans in Africa. Other colleagues here are doing work on impact of improving fertilizer markets and increasing fertilizer distribution in rural Africa. Those projects are happening in Tanzania, Malawi, Zambia, Ghana, Kenya, and also in Uganda.
Alex Winter Nelson is professor of the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics at the University of Illinois and co-author of the study. He spoke with me from Urbana-Champaign, Illinois.
The United Nations Human Rights Office is condemning violence and alleged human rights abuses that marred last week's presidential elections in Uganda. The agency also says it remains concerned by the country's tense post-electoral situation. Lisa Schlein reports from the Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights in Geneva.
UN human rights monitors say two people were killed in election-related incidents last week, one as police broke up an opposition rally, the other as police disrupted a post-election protest. They say military and police forces in the capital, Kampala, have carted off several opposition figures, including three presidential candidates, to prison. Human rights spokeswoman Cécile Puyi says these include Kizza Besigye, head of the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, who was arrested and released on three different occasions last week and arrested yet again on Monday.
We are also concerned about the intimidating display of force used on Friday by Ugandan police and military forces to evacuate the FDC headquarters in Kampala, with tear gas and live ammunition reportedly used, and by roaring information of journalists being harassed and intimidated by security forces.
President Yoweri Museveni, in office since 1986, won a fifth term by a large margin in an election which many observers describe as flawed and full of irregularities. Puyi tells VOA, UN monitors report the situation in Uganda has calmed down somewhat, but she adds the possibility of further riots cannot be ruled out. She says her agency also is concerned by the internet shutdown of the WhatsApp messenger service and Facebook just before the election.
We had obvious concerns about this shutdown and the possibility for people to exchange news. And also we understand that both applications have now been restored. We feel that the rights of the citizens to exchange information, have access to information, in this case, was seriously hampered.
The UN Human Rights Office says the government's broke a number of its obligations under international humanitarian law in its conduct of the election process. These include encroaching on people's rights to freedom of expression and peaceful assembly, the use of unnecessary force by police, and the arrest of people without informing them of the charges. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
22 minutes past the hour. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. The United Nations World Food Program says it is urgently looking for $38 million to buy food for nearly 3 million people facing starvation in Malawi. The appeal comes after the WFP extended its food relief operation by a month. Lamech Messina reports from Blantyre.
The UN and its partners have been providing food and cash assistance to hunger-stricken Malawians since last October. The country is facing its worst food shortage in a decade, largely caused by flooding and drought last year. The WFP says without additional contributions, cash distributions will have to be suspended next month, while food distributions will be drastically reduced or even discontinued by mid-April. Local media reported recently that some Malawians are surviving on maize husks, which are normally meant for animal feed. Amina Harid is a Blantyre resident. She told VOA that the government's main grain marketer, the Agriculture Development and Marketing Corporation, or ADMAC, is also short on maize.
As of now, people are sleeping in ADMAC depots waiting to purchase maize. Yeah, so last week, a woman fainted in Balaka as she was waiting to purchase maize there. So the situation is really worse now.
Currently, ADMAC depots allow an individual to buy only 20 kilograms of maize at a time. Haridi says this is not enough.
You can tell a family of 10 to get 20 kgs. That means they will only eat in the afternoon. What happens to them in the evening? That means they have to go back to the ADMAC depot to purchase another 20 kg for that evening.
Private maize traders, the WFP says, have taken advantage of the shortage situation by raising prices 175% higher, making it increasingly difficult to many people to buy food. Opposition leader in Parliament, Lazarus Chakwera, asked the National Assembly on Monday to observe a minute of silence to remember people who have died because of hunger. Food rights activist Tamani Nkono said the food shortage situation could have been minimized.
In June 2015, there was an announcement that there's going to be an El Nino. And we all know the effects of El Nino. It's either going to be floods, it's either going to be drought. So now, having been told who would have come up with a good package to prepare for that. But that package was never there. Instead, investments went into rain-fed agriculture when we knew that rain is going to be a problem.
Malawi government authorities vehemently deny there is a food shortage. Minister of Agriculture Alan Chembegeza said last week that the government has procured 50,000 metric tons of maize, enough to feed Malawians until the next harvest season. He said reports of a food shortage are baseless. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
This month, the new book, Eat the Heart of the Infidel, is out on shelves. It takes a detailed and complex look at the origins of Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. The author, Andrew Walker, who has years of experience living and writing about the region, tells Ricky Shryock about some misconceptions that are held about the Nigeria-born extremist group.
I've seen the rise of Boko Haram from 2009 onwards and seen the way that this country that I'd come involved with had just kind of crumbled and changed completely. And I wanted to, in some way, write about what happened, put it in a wider context. So what I wanted to write was not necessarily a blow-by-blow, bang-bang account of the violence that has come out the heart of the North, to kind of give a much more wider context to people who I think will probably be very, looking at it from outside, be very baffled at this whole situation.
What do you think is the most misunderstood thing about Boko Haram from the outside perspective of Nigeria?
The way that people come to it is they live their lives, and then occasionally they'll hear about this very violent incident and they'll kind of just look towards it and really not know how to deal with this shocking violence. And it just ends up that people just end up shaking their heads and shrugging their shoulders and just turning away. And I think one of the ways that this kind of was shown is that when people were saying, well, why don't we pay more attention to, why doesn't the media pay more attention to places like Nigeria? The media does pay attention to it. You know, it's regularly reported on by, but, you know, people don't read it as one kind of continuous thing. They just see it as being like spikes of interminable violence. And I really wanted to kind of show that there's a longer, much longer history to this story, and that there are some pretty interesting little twists and turns in it.
One of the reviews of your book says that, you know, often Boko Haram appear as nothing more than a Nigerian offshoot of Al-Qaeda, but as you present it, the Boko Haram issue is over nothing less than Nigeria's identity. Do you think that's one of the things, is that you wanted to present it from what it has to do with Nigeria? Because often when it's discussed globally, they talk about ISIS or Al-Qaeda, when Boko Haram is very Nigerian.
Absolutely. Boko Haram is this thing that it's whatever the people who are commenting on it at that moment want it to be. For the longest time, people were desperately trying to show how this was connected to Al-Qaeda. And then as soon as ISIS came up, as soon as the Islamic State thrust itself into the world's view, everybody turned on a sixpence and started trying to connect Boko Haram with Islamic State. And that really kind of woke me up to the fact that a lot of these analysts who prepare reports for Washington, D.C., for London, look at it solely in a way that, how is it going to affect us? To do that is perfectly understandable. That's their job. But you miss a whole load of layers of what is actually going on the ground. You know, what's happening in Nigeria is all of these different regional power struggles. You miss that. And I think that's what's really happening.
That was Andrew Walker, journalist and author of Eat the Heart of the Infidel. He was speaking to Ricky Shryock from London. This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yais Ruhib in Washington. It's 29 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to African News Tonight for the latest sports, feature, and more. Coming up next, right here on VOA. For the full hour of African News Tonight, tune in again at 1800 UTC.
The best footballers must have dedication and teamwork. And to end malaria, we need this same unity. Malaria stops footballers from scoring and children from learning. Join with footballer Didier Drogba.
Malaria is preventable and treatable.
Join with leaders like President Kikwete.
United, we can beat malaria.
This is African News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Kenyan officials arrest more than 650 people following explosions yesterday that left six people dead. The ICC again postpones the trial of Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta. And the UN Refugee Agency says violence in the Central African Republic has become more widespread. Coming up, we'll have music from Malawi. And in our feature segment, Nigeria's military battles Boko Haram. I'm Kim Lewis with Yehias Wuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. Of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are topping it off with Olympic news.
Kim, the countdown continues for the Rio Olympics in Brazil. Our VOA Olympic fans will remember the opening ceremony will be August 5th at the Maracanã Stadium in Rio de Janeiro. The stadium also hosted the final of the 2014 FIFA World Cup football tournament when Germany defeated Argentina 1-0 in extra time. Joining us now from Rio with an update on the city's Olympic preparations is our friend Luis Piazzi. Luis reports a female Brazilian football star will be in the spotlight shortly before the opening ceremony.
2 days before the opening ceremony for the Olympics in Rio, Miss Marta, the Brazilian 50 times on the row best female soccer player of the world, will kick the ball on August 3rd and light up the slogan of the Olympic Games, Live Your Passion in Rio de Janeiro. There is a saying that the women are more unpredictable than men, so anything can happen, but we can dream of Brazilians playing the final against USA women national team, three consecutive times gold medal, the queens of Olympic soccer. Again, about gender, the International Olympic Committee has announced a new rule for transgender athletes to adapt to current social, scientific, and legal attitudes on transgender issues. According to the new guidelines, female-to-male athletes can now take a part in Olympics without surgery, and male-to-female athletes must undergo only hormone therapy. What is for the prep of the event? We asked the mayor of the city, Mr. Eduardo Paes, to speak up on three current important matters, security, health, and environment, related to the Olympic Games, where $10 billion was committed so far. He answered back that none of these are his assignment. The health, including Zika, is a Minister of Health business, a federal issue as it is the security, said the mayor. The environment inquired about the pollution of the Bay for water sports, he said we should ask the State of Rio Water and Sewage Company. We are on it. But one question without answer so far is about a contingency plan on the nuclear power plants, Angra 1, Angra 2, plus a third being built, away just half an hour drive from the Olympic Village. These plants have been temporarily shut down more than once a couple of years ago due to accidents, malfunctioning of equipment, or expired insurance contract. On Zika, the experts don't know just yet how to cure infected people. Officials are confident Zika is not a problem for the Olympics. Top seeds athletes alternate opinions. The ex-number one Rafael Nadal, defeated last Saturday by the Uruguayan Pablo Cuevas, Hill Open champion, said he is not worried with the Zika frenzy. The top Spanish swimmer, Mireia Belmonte, would consider not traveling to Brazil because of Zika. The windsurfer, the Spanish Olympic gold medalist, Neil Mam, Marina Labao, said she got Zika in Brazil last December, but it won't stop her to come back in August. Kitty Schiller, Australian Olympic Mission Director, said this weekend to the Herald Sun, the Australian girls are prohibited to walk by favelas in Rio, among other areas considered highly dangerous. Also, the girls, if planning to get pregnant after the Games, should think twice. Yet, about Zika, we asked Thomas Barrows and Joe Morris, U.S. 49ers sailing team, and here is what Joe said from Baltimore.
Yeah, we're extremely excited to sail on the bay. We haven't had much experience there before, but from what we've heard, the conditions can be quite nice. You know, some people do have concerns about the quality of the water.
In the meantime, a batch of transgene male mosquito made by Oxitec, a British company owned by Intraxon, based in Maryland, flies in two cities in Brazil just as a test. The transgene mosquito should get the female Zika pregnant and kill her baby before it infects humans. This is Luis Piazzi for the Sunny Side of Sports.
Sports here, now, on the Sunny Side of Sports.
Follow the Sunny Side of Sports on Facebook and Twitter. My Facebook address is facebook.com/VOA Sunny, and my Twitter handle is @VOA Sunny Sports. One of my Facebook friends in Eldoret, Kenya, Sammy Kitter, sent me a nice logo to help celebrate the Voice of America's 74th birthday on Wednesday, February 24th. That's right, VOA sports fans. Our first broadcast was on February 24th, 1942. Listeners in Europe heard the Battle Hymn of the Republic. Then German language announcer William Harlan Hale expressed the policy of VOA. The news may be good or bad, but we shall tell you the truth. I also encourage our Voice of America listeners to check out the Sunny Side of Sports blog. The address is blogs.voanews.com/sunny. Once again, that address, blogs.voanews.com/sunny. VOA intern Rick Narcisse is guest blogger for the latest post titled Moutier Makes Mark in the NBA. And Rick writes about Denver Nuggets rookie point guard Emmanuel Moutier, who has an interesting international background. The 19-year-old Moutier was born in the Democratic Republic of Congo, grew up here in the United States, and played 1 year of professional basketball in China. In NBA action Monday night, the defending champion Golden State Warriors beat the host Atlanta Hawks 102-92. Reigning league most valuable player Stephen Curry scored 36 points for the Warriors, who became the fastest team in NBA history to 50 wins. The Warriors, with only 5 losses, beat the mark set by the 1995-1996 Chicago Bulls, who needed 56 games to win 50. Elsewhere around the NBA, the Washington Wizards host Anthony Davis and the New Orleans Pelicans later Tuesday night. Davis is coming off one of the best performances of the season. He scored a club record 59 points and pulled down 20 rebounds Sunday to lead the Pelicans to a 111-106 win over the Detroit Pistons. Davis joins the now retired Shaquille O'Neal and Chris Webber as the only NBA players with 50 points and 20 rebounds in a game since 1983. Turning to African athletics, the VOA's Daybreak Africa sportsman Mark Ouma caught up with a Zimbabwean athlete who's hoping to compete at the Rio Olympics.
Zimbabwe's Rutendo Nyahora aims to make her marathon debut in the Austrian capital Vienna in April. She received a confidence boost after she placed second in the women's 10 kilometers at the Best Made Road Race in the South African capital Tshwane on Saturday.
The race was okay. Like, my aim was to run under 35 minutes because now I'm busy preparing for the marathon. I haven't done my speed yet. So my aim was to run under 35 minutes, and I'm so happy because I managed to run 34:56.
You are thinking of the marathon. What are
are you aiming with in terms of marathon?
I'm aiming to qualify for the Olympics, Rio.
Yes. Well, what is your personal best?
I haven't run a marathon yet, so I'm training for my first marathon.
When and where do you plan to run your first marathon?
I'm going to run on the 10th of April, and I'm going to run Vienna Marathon.
Yes. That was Zimbabwe's Rutendo Nyahora, runner-up in women's 10 kilometers at the Best Med Road Race, speaking in Tshwane, South Africa. In Spain, Kenyan Cosmas Kiplimo Lagat ran a lifetime best of 2 hours, 8 minutes and 14 seconds to improve his course record at the Seville Marathon on Sunday. 2 years ago, he set the course record at 2 hours, 8 minutes and 33 seconds. Morocco's Hassan Aouchar was third, with South African Sibusiso Nzima fourth, in a lifetime best of 2 hours, 11 minutes and 43 seconds. In the women's race, Morocco's Kuta Boulaid was runner-up in 2 hours, 31 minutes and 25 seconds, while Kenyan Eunice Jepto placed fourth.
Thanks, Mark. That's Mark Ouma reporting from Johannesburg, South Africa. In other news, the International Association of Athletics Federations, the IAAF, has temporarily suspended Isaac Mwangi, the chief executive of Athletics Kenya. The IAAF's ethics board says it suspended Mwangi for 180 days, pending an investigation into what it calls potential subversion of anti-doping procedures in Kenya. The suspension comes after two Kenyan runners alleged in an interview with the Associated Press that Mwangi asked for a bribe to reduce their doping bans. Mwangi has denied wrongdoing, and he took temporary leave last week from his duties at Athletics Kenya. In the AP interview, Kenyan athletes Joy Sakari and Koki Manunga allege that Mwangi asked them each for a $24,000 bribe, but they could not raise the money. Sakari and Manunga both tested positive for a banned diuretic at last year's World Championships in Beijing, and they're both serving four-year bans. In addition to Mwangi, three other top officials with Athletics Kenya have already been suspended in connection with the IAAF investigation.
G'day, mates. Remember me? This is the old sports emperor with a red-hot listening tip. That's right. Give a listen to my pal, the bright and lively sunny man on the sunny side of sports, right here on the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. Dr. Larry Zamoja here, Chairman, Chief Executive, Sports Radio 88.9 Brila FM. Keep getting sporty sunshine with Sunny Young. We all do at Sports Radio 88.9 Brila FM, broadcasting out of the cities of Lagos, Abuja, Kaduna, and Onitsha in Nigeria, as well as the World Wide Web on www.brilafm.net. I tell you this. It's always a thrill, yes, a thrill, to remain on the sunny side on Brilla with Sunny. Keep listening, Africa.
Keep on the sunny side, always on the sunny side. Keep on the sunny side of life. It will help us every day. It will brighten all the way. It will keep on the sunny side of
I'm Sonny Young in Washington, and you're listening to the sunny side of sports on the Voice of America.
Voice of America!
Our African football guru, David Legg, joins us now with his latest quiz question.
Which club has qualified the most times to compete in the CAF Champions League? And that includes the former name of the competition. It was then known as the African Cup of Champions Clubs. So what we're talking about, Sonny, is way back to 1964 when this competition started. So it's between 1964 and 2015. Which club has qualified the most times to compete in the CAF Champions League.
2016 is a leap year, David, so we're going to set a deadline of Monday, February 29th, to get your entries in. David and I will now tell you where you can send your entries.
VOA! It's david.legge, and leg is spelled L-E-G-G-E, at AFP, that's Agence France Presse, .com. So I'll just repeat that one more time. It's david.legge, L-E-G-G-E, at AFP.com.
The Sunny Side of Sports welcomes your comments. You can send me email at sunny@voanews.com. Sunny is spelled S-O-N-N-Y. And pick up a pen or a pencil and a piece of paper. My full postal mailing address is The Sunny Side of Sports, Voice of America, 330 Independence Avenue Southwest, room 1613, Washington, D.C., 20237. And the first three people with correct answers to David Legge's quiz will receive some of those delightful VOA goodies. David tells me this is proving to be a tough quiz before entering the studio this evening. David's told me we still don't have three correct answers. I'm VOA's Sonny Young, and that's the Sunny Side of Sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sonny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, protecting girls from female genital mutilation in Sierra Leone. But first, some music. Here is Vivian Ndour from Senegal with Sama Nene. Vivian Andur from Senegal with Sama Nine.
In Sierra Leone, a non-governmental organization, the Desert Flower Foundation, has convinced at least 500 girls not to undergo female genital mutilation or cutting. The girls' parents signed a contract that guarantees their children will be protected from this controversial tradition until they reach the age of consent. VOA reporter Patrick Dakema has more on the story.
Desert Flower Foundation Sierra Leone is a non-profit organization working on girls' empowerment and protection against female genital cutting until they are 18, as guaranteed by the Child Rights Act. The initiative is backed by a parent organization based in Europe. It was founded by a prominent actress, Somalian Waris Diary, herself a victim of female genital cutting. The project has targeted 500 girls in the western area and southern district of Bo. The project provides the girls with monthly allowances to cover tuition for school, medical care, and their essential needs from birth till they are 18 years old. The foundation also supports educational programs and workshops for parents to help to change their minds about having their children join the Bondo society. It is women only secret group that prepares girls for adulthood, including female genital mutilation or FGM. The Desert Flower Foundation wants to build intra and interpersonal relationship based on compassion and understanding. It organizes crusade informing beneficiaries and parents about the dangers of FGM. The NGO also works to create awareness on civil and political rights for girls and gender equality. Wiata Genda is the program manager of Desert Flower Foundation, Sierra Leone. She says many girls before their intervention drop out of school because of poverty, noting that allowances provided have cushioned problems faced by girls. Desert Flower Foundation says its initiatives have reduced the number of dropouts, early marriage, teenage pregnancy, and further motivated girls to aspire for higher learning. Elizabeth Kuma, whose daughter is benefiting from the foundation, explains why she allowed her to join.
I let my daughter join this organization because I want to maintain her standard. The standard to maintain their womanhood, the early sexual stage. I want her to maintain her virginity. That's why I joined her in this Desert program. Oh, I'm benefiting a lot, and that alone can help her to maintain herself so that she may not be influenced to join those bad girls who are initially initiated in the Bondo society.
Kroma explained her own position on FGM for herself and her daughter.
Well, actually, I'm not against. No, I have no right to influence her because she has the right now to decide for herself whether she's willing to join the Bondo society or to be initiated in the Bondo society. I will not force her to join the Bondo society.
Kadiatu Rogers is a 17-year-old high school pupil attending Queen of the Rosary Secondary School in Bow City. She joined the Desert Flower program at age 14 and expressed her delight for the support received.
As for me, I like the idea because it benefits me so much. Because every day I allow us to give to my grandmom, she uses it to pay my school fees sometimes. Because I want to maintain my virginity. I don't want to be like some girls outside. Well, I may have to take my decision for myself, but not going out bad. Well, I may like to thank the Desert Flower because they have done well for me, even for my school fees or lunch or so whatsoever. So I may like to encourage my friends or sisters to be part of this. Well, I may like to say if they have any assistance for anyone or if they like to continue with the organization, I may like to say they may continue. Because, like, as for me, my grandmom and my aunt cares for me. And my grandmom is getting old. So I won't say I should wait until he gets home. So I may like them to continue with the organization.
Project officials says the initiative needs to spread beyond the two provinces being served. The third largest region in the north has high levels of female genital mutilation and has only 14 girls involved with Desert Flower. But officials say there is room for expansion and expect project to grow in other regions throughout the country. This is Patrick Jakema reporting from Bo, South Sierra Leone.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Yehiz Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Kwame Afori, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Officials from the U.S. government's Millennium Challenge Corporation, the MCC, visited Côte d'Ivoire this month to congratulate the government on its eligibility to develop an MCC Compact program. In December 2015, the MCC Board of Directors selected Côte d'Ivoire as Compact eligible following several years of steady improvement by the government of Côte d'Ivoire on the MCC scorecard of policy indicators and a strong year-long partnership with MCC in developing an MCC threshold program for which Côte d'Ivoire became eligible in December 2014. Compacts are large, five-year investments that address a country's greatest constraints to economic growth, and threshold programs are smaller-scale investments designed for countries that don't yet qualify for a compact. The work done by Côte d'Ivoire on threshold program development will provide a solid foundation for an innovative compact program. On its most recent MCC scorecard, Côte d'Ivoire passed 13 out of 20 indicators, demonstrating remarkable improvement from passing only 5 indicators in 2013. Since its selection for eligibility for a threshold program, the government of Côte d'Ivoire has been a committed and collaborative partner. The government has remained highly engaged with indicator institutions, identifying reforms and providing data updates needed to improve its overall performance. U.S. Ambassador Terrence McCulley said, "The MCC Compact is a strong symbol of the United States' partnership with Côte d'Ivoire as it moves toward its goal of becoming an emerging economy by 2020. In its selection decision, MCC's board also expressed its support for Côte d'Ivoire to explore potential regional investments with neighboring countries. MCC recognizes that growth is more dependent than ever on economic integration. Countries can grow faster, create more jobs, and attract more investment when they are part of dynamic regional markets. The potential for a regional investment is great, given the critical role Côte d'Ivoire plays in the West Africa region." Côte d'Ivoire's transition from developing a threshold program to developing a compact program is a testament to the country's continued commitment to strong policy improvement and political stability, as evidenced by its recent presidential elections.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa. We'll discuss the beauty of Africa with me, Esther Githui-Ewart, as guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
African music hits.
Everyone is looking for something special when maybe they should just listen instead. The VOA's African music mix will soothe your nerves and calm your head. Tune in from 0 to 300 UTC and 1100 to 1300 hours UTC to make you feel good. So treat yourself to that something special.